to episode 357 of the Comic Source Podcast, Superman Sunday, and today we're going to be talking about Man of Steel number 2. I'm your host, Jace.
And I'm Nick.
And welcome to the show, everybody. So, as I said, it's Superman Sunday, and for you listeners not familiar, we decided that, well, we've been talking for a while about wanting to cover some various Superman stories over the years. He's my favorite character, and we thought it would be a really good time to kick it off now that we have the Man of Steel story coming out weekly from DC Comics. It's Brian Michael Bendis's first work for DC, first significant work. I mean, he did a short story in Batman Black and White back in the day, and you know, he had a real short story in DC Nation Zero that was kind of a prelude to the politics and the current goings-on, the state of the Daily Planet. And then, of course, in Action Comics 1000, he had a short story that was kind of like a preview of what we're starting to see in Man of Steel. I don't think we're at the point in Man of Steel where that event has taken place, like, timeline-wise. So what's been interesting – well, let me give the creative team first. So Man of Steel Part 2, as I mentioned, Brian Michael Bendis writing. We've got Evan Doc Shaner on the art for pages 1 through 13. Then we've got a double-page spread for page 14 and 15 by Jason Fabok. And then we've got pages 16 through 24 by Steve Rude. And then the colors are by Alex Sinclair, letters by Josh Reed. So what's been interesting is just how popular and how well the Superman comics have done since Rebirth. A lot of people say that it's the best Superman stories that DC's told in many, many years, maybe since before the death of Superman or right around that era. And so, you know, the writer on Action was Dan Jurgens, same writer that was on the Superman title back then in that heyday when Superman was doing really well in terms of sales. The Superman title was being written by Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason, and Patrick was handling some of the art duties from time to time as well. But when Brian Michael Bendis decided he needed a creative change and decided to come over to Marvel, the character that he wanted to work on was Superman. You know, most people would think Batman, but it actually was Superman. So despite the success and the critical acclaim that the two Superman titles were getting at that time, DC kind of gave the reins over to Brian Michael Bendis to tell the story that he wanted to tell. And they decided to start doing it by releasing a six-week event called The Man of Steel. So there aren't any other Superman titles being put out right now while the Man of Steel is coming out. They even put Super Sons and Supergirl on hiatus until June, or till August rather, just so there's nothing else crowding out where Superman is. And the reason I mention all this is just because of kind of the state of where Superman was with Jurgens and Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason handling the reins. Lois, again, this is as we discussed last Superman Sunday, this version of Superman is the pre-Flashpoint Superman. It's the same Superman that Dan Jurgens would consider his Superman, the Superman he killed, the Superman that John Byrne relaunched in 1986 with his Man of Steel series, the Superman that was powered down after the Crisis on Infinite Earths, the Superman that at one point became Superman Blue, the electric blue Superman, and then split into Superman Red and Blue. He's a beloved character, this version of the character, and the New 52 Superman died at the end of that New 52 run. We talked about that last Superman Sunday as well. But with the Convergence event and then the Superman Lois and Clark series that Dan Jurgens wrote, he managed to bring his version, his Superman, Superman that, again, is a beloved version, into the current DC universe. I don't know that Brian Michael Bendis necessarily wanted that baggage that came with the character. Don't know that he wanted him to be married to Lois. Didn't know that Bendis wanted him to have a son. I mean, he's never had a chance to write the character before, and whether or not you liked what Juergens and Tomasi and Gleason were doing or not, you have to admit that having Superman married, having Superman have a son, puts certain restrictions on what you can do as a writer. It's a lot harder. You've got more hoops to jump through. Say you want to take Superman out into space for 6 or 8 months. You know, everybody's going to be wondering, well, what are Lois and John doing back on Earth? You're going to have to dedicate some space to that, maybe. If he removes them from the playing field, he kind of gets around that. So it's definitely a mystery. It's at the heart of what I want to know the answer to right from the start, from issue one. And Nick and I talked about the couple pages by Jason Fabok in the first issue could possibly foreshadow some kind of crisis event where they met. And I've talked to a couple guys at the comic shop. One of them mentioned Monitor, perhaps? A Monitor messing with time? So, I don't know. It's yet to be determined. But let me do a quick synopsis on issue two. But before I do that, what were your thoughts on issue two, Nick? Especially as it compared to issue one. Do you think it was better, worse?
I didn't like it as much as issue one. But I still enjoyed it quite a bit. Of course, I don't know how much you want me to talk about the story at this point.
Well, let me do the synopsis and then we'll break it down more. I myself, just real quick, I didn't quite enjoy it as much as issue one either. Part of that was the art, which I'll talk about, break it down. I mentioned a little bit on New Comics Wednesday as well. But let me break the story down first. It's interesting that the first page of this issue kind of mirrors the first page of issue one, where it's just a scene, a big cosmic scene, one planet. This is actually Krypton, and it's at the moment of its destruction, it's starting to explode. See all the green light coming out of it. And we are looking back in the past. We see that word then, period, again. And the caption is, Krypton is no more. And Milky Way, Galactic Center, we see Lord Gandello talking to one of the Guardians. And I think this is actually Ganthet, who's one of the more known Guardians of the Universe, I'll say. And they're basically discussing, Lord Gandello is basically accusing Ganthet somewhat of knowing what was going to happen, of knowing that Rogol Zar was going to destroy Krypton. I mean, he had come and asked the Galactic Council, or whatever they're called, for permission to cleanse the galaxy of Kryptonians. He felt they were overstepping their bounds and were persecuting lesser civilizations and planets. But ultimately, Rogol Zar's request was denied, and Gandello seems to be accusing Ganthet of knowing more. Like, we told you, Ganthet, to go tell Rogol Zar the answer was no. We don't actually know what you told him. So, you were supposed to go tell him that his request was denied, and now all of a sudden Krypton's no more. Ganthet's like, I don't want to hear that. I'm not going to entertain this. And Gandela's like, well, we'll see what everybody else thinks. And Ganthet, he makes a really good point. Well, first he mentions about how Rogol Zar, he's a legendary creature. He's bathed in the blood of millions of souls to fight for what he believes in. If he took it upon himself to betray the Galactic Circle, that's what they're called, that he had sworn to protect, if he went behind our backs to rid himself, or rid the universe of an entire species, what do you think's going to happen if you pursue this line of questioning? I mean, Ganthet's got a really good point, and I love the expression on Gandela's face. He's like, he hadn't even considered that, you can tell. Like, oh, good point. Because Ganthet continues, if your theory is true, You should hope that Rogal Zar was in the heart of Krypton when it exploded, that he sacrificed himself for what he believed. Because if not, and you pursue him and try to, I don't know, bring him to justice for what he's done, he asked permission to cleanse the galaxy from Krypton and Kryptonians. You guys told him no. He went behind your back and managed to destroy a whole world, a whole civilization. And now you're going to investigate that? What do you think he's going to do if he survived, if he wasn't in the heart of Krypton when it exploded? And Ganthet says to himself, "We did not see this coming," and kind of kneels into the dust of that asteroid there. Then he goes looking for Rogal Zar, the training planet, that brutal planet we saw in issue one, and doesn't seem to find him. And Ganthet says, I hope you've died with your final sin, and this and all the other ugly secrets disappear with you. So that's an interesting turn of phrase there, right, Nick? Because we had talked in the first episode about adding this to the Superman origin, basically. Adding this this piece, right, to the origin, that Rogal Zar had something to do with the destruction of Krypton. And just that little word, secret, that Bendis throws in there, I guess that's his way of saying, yeah, look, this could have been the case all along, but no one knew because it was a secret.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of interesting.
That's what I was saying last time. It should be like a kind of a thing that happened, but it's only now being like...
Well, yeah, I mean, you kind of
revealed. It was always part of the mythology under the surface.
Yeah, and you kind of have to do it that way. I mean, that's the same way that Snyder did it with the Court of Owls, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I said I liked that last time, whereas you weren't as big a fan. But.
I just think that, yeah, I'm not. I'm not a fan. I mean, I see what he's doing. I'm not necessarily a fan of adding to it. Because again, and I talked about this last time, it's like if every writer that comes onto Superman has to tweak the origin or add a little this, a little that, it just starts getting too convoluted. And it needs to be simple. But I mean, and if you look at the history of Krypton and the history of Superman – you know, he's as a character is symbolic of why DC did the Crisis on Infinite Earths to begin with, and why Byrne insisted when he rebooted Superman that Superman be the only Kryptonian that survived, because over the years, right, the what was it, 50 years, I suppose, of DC history. Okay, first it was just Superman, then it was Superman and Supergirl, then it was General Zod, and then it was a couple of General Zod's lieutenants, and then it was this person and that person, and all of a sudden, before you knew it, you had like a couple hundred people who survived. And in Byrne's thought, like his estimation, it was like the more people you have surviving the destruction of Krypton, the less special it is, right? How can he be the last son of Krypton when there's 200 of them? There's 200 last sons and daughters of Krypton. So it's kind of the same thing. And also there was only green kryptonite instead of, you know, at that point there had been green kryptonite, red kryptonite, black kryptonite, blue kryptonite, rainbow kryptonite, yellow kryptonite, gold kryptonite. It was like, you know,
polka dot kryptonite.
Yeah. Every time you add one on, it lessens it. Right. So that was his point. And so I kind of feel the same way about the origin. When you start bolting all these other pieces on, over time, eventually you get to a point where you got to say, okay, it's too much. We got to tear it all down and start over. Which, you know, if you're Marvel, whatever, you start over every week. Like at this point, Marvel's, I mean, they just came out this week with all their fresh start, like four or five new series. You know what they need to do? They need to just stop putting numbers on the covers. Just don't even put numbers anymore. Everything's at number one.
Just the month and the year.
Yeah. Don't even put numbers.
That makes more sense to me anyway when it comes to a lot of complex. I'm looking at them, I'm like, when is this from?
Yeah, definitely. Anyway.
It's like a magazine, month and year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyway, getting back to the synopsis, we move to now. We're in the Daily Planet. We see that the girl that we met in the DC Nation Zero, Robin Good, she's the new City Desk reporter. She's hitting up the Gossam columnist asking about Lois Lane. And Trish Q says, "I'm an art and leisure reporter, not gossip." Like, oh, okay. Anyway, where is she? What's going on? What's the angle? And Trish says, why don't you go ask her estranged husband? Again, that word estranged, right? Mr. Clark Kent. I would, but he hasn't made eye contact yet. And they talk a little bit about Clark and how every reporter has a secret. And Robin Good remarks, oh, so there is a secret. You can almost, you know, see her reporter's instinct kick in there. And then Perry makes an announcement. Everybody stop asking about Lois Lane's office. You want the office right as good as she did. Get back to work. So then they start wondering, well, where is Kent? Ah, that's the thing. Lois and Clark, even on a normal day, they don't live by the same rules as us, right? Like Clark, they're rarely there. They're always running around, getting the story, and as far as Clark's concerned, saving the world as Superman. So he's actually in Coast City, and we see him fighting a giant robot above the city, and turns out it's occupied by Toy Man. And he kind of complains, kind of similar to Killer Moth and Firefly last issue. He's like, dude, you're not supposed to be here. You're in Metropolis. Like, what? Like, I came here to get away from you. Like, why are you? And then Green Lantern shows up and he says, hey, I called you about dinner last week. Didn't hear back. I guess I should have made a giant robot attack something. Then you'd show up. And Superman, it's good to see you, Green Lantern. And Toy Man continues to prattle on. So Green Lantern puts him in a soundproof bubble, which I love. And then Hal says, hey, what's been happening with you? And Superman, Clark Kent replies, actually, can you give me a quote for Clark Kent's article about this? And Hal ignores him, says, you know, you didn't show up for the league meeting on Tuesday. There's rumors. And Superman cuts him off. Everything's okay. Green Lantern says, but I heard, thanks for the assist, Hal. Gotta go. And runs off. And look on his face, you can see that he just, something's bothering him.
So, do you think this is before Justice League number one, then? Because they're in a real crisis of that. I know that they try to keep the book separate anyway, because you can't always tie into everything, but...
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because, like, Batman pointed that one, Deathstroke pointed it out, that it, because of the wedding, that it wasn't
right
current. Which I don't do very often, so I'm just wondering where you think this rests.
Yeah, not to say that it doesn't matter. I think you could fit this in before or after.
Yeah.
But if I had to be pinned down and pick one or the other, I'll say before. Because we'll see the way the narrative plays out in Justice mm-hmm. League. That there may not be space to fit this in after, because, you know, based on the first issue of Justice League, things may change drastically. So I'd say this is probably before Justice League number one. But as Superman starts to fly at an incredible speed, and I think Doc Shaner does a great job of showing that speed through color and the way he manipulates the backgrounds, he starts flashing back again to that fateful night. Same kind of the same scene that we saw in issue one that Jason Fabok drew on the last two pages. So he Superman remembers Lois asking on the phone, did he admit to his previously undisclosed financial stake in Star Labs overseas operation? And actually that's Clark asking Lois, and she says, he's about to, he just doesn't know it. And then, Dad, what is it? Clark, get behind me, Lois. Dad, what is it? Again, it's the same language that we saw several times in the first issue before they faded out to white. But we're actually seeing it from the other angle now. When we saw it in the first issue, we were looking at the three characters. We were looking at Superman, or Clark Kent. We were looking at Lois Lane. We were looking at Jonathan Kent. Now we're behind them, and we're seeing what they see. And it looks like some giant robot or technological guy, some glowing eyes, some like tentacles coming off the back of his head, sort of. Like, I almost would think it's a Brainiac, but it doesn't look anything like any Brainiac I've ever seen.
Brainiac's one of my thoughts. It kind of looks like one of the new Titans or whatever the hell they're called.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think it would tie in that directly.
The Omega Titans?
Yeah, I don't think it is, but it kind of has the look of Brainiac or an Omega Titan with the dots, the lit up spots.
Yeah. Clearly, Rogal Zar is not the only new villain, perhaps, is what we're being led to believe here. But I will say that these pages are drawn and colored excellently by Jason Fabok and Alex Sinclair. I mean, they're gorgeous. So then as we turn to the next page, now we're into the Steve Root art. And we see that Superman, when he sped off at a high rate of speed from Green Lantern and Coast City, he actually headed for the moon. And he flies directly into it without slowing down, it looks like. And we see Foom in a big crater. And again, he's hearing the voices in his head. Dad, Dad, what is that? And clearly he's distraught. So maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was wrong when I said after the, you know, in the first issue, I just don't think he would be going on and living his life if Lois and John were somewhere and he would be out there searching for him. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's admitted they're erased from existence or something. But I could swear that I heard Bendis say that they're not going anywhere. So maybe he's taking them off the stage temporarily. Yeah, it's really too soon to say. What I can say is that we move on to Taffy's West at the far end of the Vega system. It looks like, you know, right out of Star Wars Cantina with a bunch of aliens, strange-looking bottles, somebody ordering a drink, and it turns out that somebody is Rogal Zar. And when he's at the bar, he has some kind of a necklace on that has the Superman emblem, and the bartender notices it. She says, "Superman?" And he said, "Who? That's Kryptonian." "Well, yeah, that's Superman, last son of Krypton, escaped as a baby." So the story goes. And Rogar, "What story?" So clearly, he was not aware that somebody had survived the destruction of Krypton. Again, it's tough to buy, right? It's tough to buy that he could have something to do with the destruction of Krypton for all these years. Now, I'm not even saying all these years as far as Superman's been around for 75 years. I'm saying all the years from Krypton being destroyed, Superman being sent to Earth and raised. I mean, he's got to be at least in his mid-30s here. So you're talking about, you know, 30-plus years at least.
Well, and he's, I think it depends on how confident he was in the first place. You know? Like, if he's like, "I did it. I destroyed everyone." He wasn't looking for something like this until he ran into it at a bar.
He's not looking for it here either, but if he's been wandering the galaxy for 30 and a half years, 35 years or whatever, with that emblem around his neck,
it's not on his neck. Look, it's on like the neck of like a...
Right. You're right. Yeah. Behind the bar. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's like on a mannequin or something. Okay.
Yeah, I guess I could buy that a little more then.
He just why is that around?
Yeah, he just happened to stumble into the bar and saw it. I mean, yeah, galaxy's a big place.
And eventually it would happen if he wasn't actively looking for Superman already.
Right, but still, it just so happens to happen right when Brian Michael Bendis takes over the book and right when Lois and John are off the table.
They could be related. We don't know the exact timing of this. It could be a little bit out of order.
True. True.
Like Westworld or something.
Anyway, scene shifts back to Superman. He says, "I owe Hal an apology. This is not the first time I've blown off his genuine hand of friendship. It's not him. It's not his fault. But I need to tell him that instead of just flying away. Perfect example of me taking advantage of being Superman. You know, because I'm me, people put up with me being rude, basically, more than if I was just Clark Kent." And then his thoughts are interrupted by an explosion. We see another building is on fire. This one's abandoned, if not for the homeless. More arson. And he uses his X-ray vision to try to see where the fire started. Can't. Manages to grab a couple of those crazy floaty guys that you see at car dealerships, you know, the ones that you have the air that blows up from underneath and they go like flopping all around. So he grabs a couple of those and uses them as like slides to rescue the homeless from the building right before the whole thing comes down. And then he leaves. He's like, I guess he's rescued everybody, needs to get to the Daily Planet and turn in his story about more arson. He's got quite the dapper pinstripe suit going on too in these pictures.
Oh yeah.
Meanwhile, Perry White is like not in good shape as Clark walks into his office. Hey, more arson stuff. Also have a story on Toy Man setting up shop in Coast City. But Perry is very distraught. He says, we need to start digging deeper. We need to show the public things they don't know yet. We have to do it every day, multiple times a day, or we're going to fold. So looks like the Daily Planet may be in trouble. And Clark inquires, he's like, is everything okay? Perry's like, competition's murder. It's not just other papers. Everyone's a reporter now with a news gathering device in their pocket. And I think we've been sold. Clark's very surprised. Like, what? To who? Like, you know, I don't know. Clark's like, want me to make some calls? Perry's like, I made all those calls. Couldn't find anything out. So we'll find out when we find out. My point is this conversation may be moot. We may have already been sold for parts. I mean, nobody knows what the future is. So Trish then responds. She's been listening in at the door. Why don't we give them what they want? We're sitting on the story of the year. To which Perry replies, not now, Trish. And Clark wants to know what story. You and Lois Lane. What happened, Kent? And Clark's kind of stammers, that's not... Trish says, you know, your wife's pretty well known, almost famous. Stories are swirling, rumors. My point is, whatever it is, it's about to break. We're sitting on a real exclusive. And Perry's not having any of it. He's old school. You know, the reporters do not become news. And he says as much. He's like, this is wildly inappropriate. And Trish says, well, if you want to keep the lights on a week longer, get him to talk. So meanwhile, there's some big scene on the TV in the back background. It's like a Joker mobile driving over cars. Perry says, see that? How can we compete with this live? Guy's going to kill someone on live TV. So clearly, you know, Clark sees the destruction and runs off to be Superman. But as Trish turns around and wonders where he went, Perry says, ah, you offended him because you're being so obnoxious. He left. He's out there trying to get a story. There is a story out there that will put us back in the game. It's out there. I can feel it. And in the final panel, we see Rogal Zar on some crazy looking, it almost looks like a Lobo.
That's what I was going to say.
Space cycle. And he's flying somewhere. A couple planets.
You know what else?
In the background.
You know what else it looks like? It looks like the giant face in the panel where his family disappears.
A little bit. I could see slight resemblance.
But yeah, I've thought of this character as looking like Lobo since the first panel I saw him show up in the last issue. Because like I'm reading on an iPad, so I'm not seeing both pages when it's a double spread.
Yeah.
So when I saw his back end, like the back half of the character, I'm like, is it Lobo? Before I knew what was going on last time we read it. So it's interesting he rides a motorcycle too. I was going to comment on that.
Yeah, and I really don't like to be negative. Most of the time, if there's a book I don't like, we don't cover it. There's enough books that I do like, that we do like. There's enough positive books out there to keep us more than busy. But once in a while, things like this come along and you have to talk about it. You have to talk about Man of Steel. You have to talk about Justice League number one. You have to talk about the big events that are going to change the course of a publisher's, you know, universe. Like,
of course,
Doomsday Clock, or you know, whatever, Secret Wars, Secret Empire, things like that. You have to talk about them. So I say that to say this: I'm not a fan of Steve Rude's art here, and I'm not saying Steve Rude's a bad artist by any stretch of the imagination. I've seen the guy draw some incredible stuff, and I don't know if it's because he's inking himself. I don't know if it was because he was rushed. There are some of the pages that look great. The page with Perry White, where mm-hmm. you get four different versions of him. You know, you can see clearly he's distraught. He's worried the paper that he's given his life to is going to fold. And right below the picture of his face, which shows how upset he is, a lot of emotion. We see him as a cub reporter on a old Underwood typewriter. We see him on an electric typewriter. We see him on an old IMB, which would be an IBM computer, desktop computer. And then we see him with a laptop.
I love that.
In current time. I mean, it's great to see him age, you know, from a young cub reporter to, you know, seasoned veteran to you know, editor in chief. That's awesome. That's incredible art. It's great storytelling by Steve Rude. But for the most part, I don't like his art in this issue, specifically whenever he draws the alien stuff, whenever he draws Rogol Zar. I mean, Rogol Zar is so detailed when you see the way Jim Lee drew him in Action Comics 1000, when you see the way that Ivan Reis drew him in issue one. And here, he looks very simplistic. It doesn't have any pupils in his eyes. He just doesn't look right. Just not a fan of the art. So again, I'm not sure if it's because he's inking himself, which the previous art I've seen from him that looks spectacular, that wasn't the case, or if he was rushed. But I feel like that this is a big part of the reason that this issue feels lesser quality than issue one. Because I feel like the first half of the issue's got a great art. I mean, the Fabok pages are amazing. The Doc Shaner pages are really great. And I just wish he had drawn the whole issue. So, I don't know. It's just my two cents. As far as the story goes, I'm more worried now than I was at the end of reading the first issue that Jonathan and Lois have been taken off the stage, even if it's just temporarily. But again, like I was talking about earlier, I understand why Bendis would want to do it. And I don't even necessarily think it's a bad thing, but for me personally, my Superman stories need to have a Lois. And I've really come to like Jonathan Kent as a character. So, not having him in the book, I think, would be a detriment as well. But maybe it's just these six issues, right? Maybe at the end of the six issues, Bendis gets it out of his system, tells whatever story he feels like he needs to tell without them. But you almost think, okay, well, he could have just come out in the first issue and said, okay, this is where they are. They'll be back. Or is it going to be a mystery that drags throughout the whole miniseries? Just not sure. Just not sure. But very anxiously awaiting the next issue, which we should get tomorrow, Friday, when we get our preview copy. So we'll be able, be able to check. I'm not going to be able to wait. I'm going to have to like open it up immediately and flip through it.
Yeah, send it to me this time.
I'll have to remember that. Hint, hint. I thought it was a great issue, not as good as the first one, which was absolutely amazing. But again, and I think I mentioned this in, when we talked in the first issue, I had problems with that as well. Worried about Lois and Jonathan being gone, not liking the whole, I think, was her name Melody Moore, the flirty fire chief?
Like I said, a Marvel name.
Yeah, who doesn't show up in this at all. So it certainly wasn't perfect. But I'd rate it slightly higher than this one. So interesting to see where it's going to go from here. The other thing that's going to be interesting to see, and I mentioned this in the first episode as well, is it may be a series that we can't accurately grade or give a rating to until we've read the whole thing to see where it goes. But also with the way the art – we're already getting like different artists on each of the six issues, and now we're even getting two different artists on the same issue. And I understand it's because DC wanted to release them weekly, and so it makes it a lot tougher, much tighter deadline. It's hard for one artist to have enough time. With enough lead time, they could have done it, but they probably didn't have enough lead time with Bendis getting sick and everything. So how's that going to play in the trade, right? It's jarring enough when it's each issue is drawn by a different artist. Now you're talking about two artists on the same issue. I don't know. When it reads in the trade, that may pull you out of the story. And in my opinion, when you're reading a comic, anything that has to do with the art, the colors, the lettering that pulls you out of the story, anything where you notice it is not a good thing. I mean, every once in a while, you'll see a splash page or something so amazing that you're just like, whoa, and it can slightly pull you out of the narrative. But nothing pulls you out of the narrative like bad coloring, bad art, bad lettering, or bad storytelling from panel to panel where it's confusing and you're flipping back and forth between pages trying to figure out, wait, what happened? Yeah, those are not good things. And so I worry that all the different art styles may do that when people try to pick it up in the trade. And so far, the story's been pretty good, so you don't want any distractions like that. What do you have to add, Nick?
Well, as far as someone who's newer to comics and does still put story before art based on screenwriting background and stuff, like, even though it's not exactly the same, I'm kind of comparing apples to oranges, because one's like a book of short stories that aren't related, and one is a continuous book. But like, reading a book like this with artists changing, if it was a trade paperback, wouldn't bother me any more than like reading Batman Black and White, where each story is a different artist, even though they are different stories. I don't know. It's not something that I find consistency in art throughout a story isn't something that's as important to me as consistency in writing, which I still think is weaker on this issue than the last issue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think consistency in writing is more important than consistency in art for the most part. But again, it comes down to your personal preference, right? There are people that pick up comics more for the art than they do for the story.
That's why I sound like such a fool on our artist spotlight, is because I don't know anything about art. So I can give you
a great example, and maybe you even read this. Another weekly title that came out not so long ago from DC, Batman Eternal.
Mm-hmm. I used to read that all the time.
You read Batman Eternal? Okay.
Every issue.
Again, weekly series, so you had the art changing. Some of them were drawn by Jason Fabok, and the art was spectacular. Some of them were done by some artists where I was like, this is a Batman title. This is a weekly Batman title. You guys are promoting the heck out of it. It's pretty important. And you've got some artists on there who I've never heard of before, and frankly, stuff just is not very good. So again, it didn't necessarily ruin the story for me, and I didn't read it in, you know, trades. I did read
it. Yeah, I read it issue to issue.
Yeah, I read it issue to issue as well. But it did – it was noticeable at times. It'd be like, you know, get three or four pages into the story and then just be like, who is drawing this? And flip back and look and be like, man, I've never even heard of this person before. This art really isn't very good. And there were some issues where I felt the art was so bad, I didn't want to finish reading it. I was just like, man, it's a chore to get through this. The art is so bad. But I got through it because I wanted to have the complete story. I don't think that this art is anywhere near that bad. Not even – I mean, I wouldn't even say this art's bad. I would say this art just doesn't suit the story that's being told. And I think I said this when we talked about it in the most recent New Comic Wednesday episode, that Steve Rude's art, like where it works, like on that Perry White page, there's not a lot of panels. His art has room to breathe. He has a thicker line. His line weights are much heavier. He needs more space. His art just needs more space. And part of what I don't like is it just feels crowded. Like in the cantina scenes, there's so much going on. Like if you took that first scene of the cantina where it says far end of the Vegas system and blew that up to like a full page splash, I don't think I'd have any problem with it. But as it stands, it just looks a little too busy. But I'm not saying that this art is anywhere near as bad as some of the art on Batman Eternal. But again, it just, if it pulls me out of the story, just, and this is just my opinion, this is my, you know, how I feel about it personally. If the art is so bad that it pulls me out of the story, then to me, that's not good art. And this art didn't do that, but it was noticeable. So,
yeah. No, I would agree. If I noticed stuff like that, it would definitely draw me out of it. But like, even going back to Batman Eternal, especially, that was even earlier comics me. So I definitely didn't notice stuff back then. I'm beginning to notice stuff now, thanks to you.
But yeah, I'd be curious.
Back then it was all about story.
I'd be curious if we go back and look at Batman Eternal like in another year or so.
I bet I'd notice now.
Yeah, you'd probably be like, man, what is it? Who's this artist? Who's this? I'd be like, I don't know. I never heard of him either. Yeah, it's pretty bad. All right. Anything else to say about Man of Steel number 2?
No, I think one of the most interesting things for me was that they repeated the theme joke or whatever it is about the villain who thinks he's acting within the rules of escaping Superman and still gets caught. I don't know if Bendis is fixated on it or if he's going to make a longer point about it, but I find it very interesting that we have two situations like that where it's like, hey, I was like living under the rules of Superman. You shouldn't have caught me.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be here.
It may just be that he is trying to show that Superman can be anywhere at any time.
And I like that angle.
Just trying to show that he's, I don't want to say omniscient. And all powerful, but he you know, trying to show that he does have that level of power.
Yeah. Because is that, I'm going to be honest, I got my villains confused. I thought it was, I was confusing, is it Toymaker? Is that his name here also? I was confusing with the Spider-Man villain.
Toyman.
I was feeling, earlier I was like, why is he younger than the last time I saw him? And I'm like, oh, the last time I saw this character was Spider-Man, and that's a different character. Yeah. But is he a Superman villain then, or a Batman villain?
No, Toyman is a Superman villain.
Okay.
And he's looked like this since that 86 reboot. Prior to that, he looked more like the Toy Man from the Super Friends cartoon, where he looked like kind of in a jester's costume.
Oh, yeah.
With the little hat, yeah. The bells, whatever. But yeah, since the reboot, he's looked more like this. And his last name's Shot. I think it's Winslow Shot. so if you watch, do you watch the Supergirl TV show at all?
I am behind on all my CW shows, except the ones that have John Constantine in them, those episodes.
Because I know they put in a character that was the last name Shot that works at the same place that Supergirl does, and so there was speculation on if they were going to bring the Toy Man into Supergirl or whatever. So yeah,
I need to watch that. I love stuff like that.
I guess that that wraps it up. I find it interesting that they're doing the Fabok pages as the part that I want to know the most about with Lois and John. So hopefully we get more than just one. I mean, the difference between what we knew in issue one and issue two, all we have is this image of this giant head. That's the only difference. All the language is the same. It's like, come on, give me something more. So that may, I mean, I know that Fabok's doing two pages in each issue, and then he's doing like the entire issue six. So it may not be till issue six that we find out Lois and Jonathan's fate. Maybe it's all kind of set up and here's the status of Superman until we get to set. I hope that's not what it is, because that'll feel like a little bit of a cheat to me. But yeah, I don't know. It was a good issue, not a great issue. I think the first issue was great. So again, we'll see how it plays out.
Looking forward to it.
All right, I guess that's going to do it for this episode of Superman Sunday. Don't forget, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. While you're there, be sure and check out all our other coverage on TVs, movies, all that other great pop culture stuff. Twitter.com/TheComicSource is where we can be found on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are great spots to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. And of course, speaking of conventions, 1 week from today, actually 1 week from yesterday, Friday, June 15th, is the beginning of Denver Comic Con. Nick and I will be there all 3 days. If you're going to be there, hit us up on the aforementioned Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram to meet up with us and tell us what you like about the show, grab a quick picture, give you a shout out on an episode, as well as hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard. So always love to meet listeners. So once again, thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.